Hi, my name is Claude King, and my black is transnational.
You are listening to Season 5 of My Dad's Podcast, My Black is Transnational, a podcast about blackness and reconnecting back to our native homelands. Find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Check us out on YouTube. You can follow us on Instagram or blacktransnational.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome into another episode of My Black is Transnational. Coming up on this episode, I'll be joined by my good brother, Mr. Claude King, who's a psychotherapist and an advocate for black men's mental health. We'll be having a real heart-to-heart conversation just about fatherhood, masculinity, and culture. But before we get into that, of course, let's go through our formalities. If this is your first time listening to My Black is Transnational, you can find this podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, whether it's Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere else that you like to listen to your favorite podcast. You can also find a video version of our podcast on YouTube. Check us out there. Just look up My Black Transnational Podcast. And then you can follow us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Check us out at Black Transnational Podcast. You can check us out at MBI Transnational on Twitter. And then, of course, follow our website. If you don't want to do any of those things, you can definitely check out our website at www.blacktransnational.com. That's a one-stop shop for everything you need to know about this podcast. Learn about the guests. You can even binge seasons from the past, and you can even listen to the most current episode like this one. And so, that's everything you need to know. And then, of course, follow me, the host, on Instagram at blacktransnational_. Yes. So about this episode, I thought this was a very, very authentic and just a true conversation between two black men. I went to college with Claude. Like I said, we are part of the same fraternity. And so we are fraternal brothers in that regard from the same chapter. And so we have, you know, connection there that, you know, kind of speaks to our relationship and history. But even beyond that, right, just being able to have a real conversation that we've never had before, you know, even though we've known each other this long. And so I was very grateful that Claude and I got to just sit and talk for him, sharing his background, his experiences, and how it ties into his roots, go all the way down to the deep south, and how that serves as a beacon of pride for him and his family, and how he perceives himself as a man, and the role models around him that kind of, set the standard for what it is in terms of how he shaped his masculinity, but then how he also evolved and went his own path to discover ways to improve and advocate for mental health and mental health wellness among black men specifically, but men in general. And then, you know, we both just talk about the importance of fatherhood and the importance of being able to allow ourselves to be vulnerable and allow ourselves to engage in therapy to help improve our mental health, and how our culture interplays with these types of practices or don't even align or agree with these practices at times. And so we really have a rich, and I say this all the time, but I really do think that in this particular episode, you'll get to see or hear a side of me in terms of just for fatherhood, in terms of just how I feel emotionally when it comes to how I perceive my masculine identity, which is not something I often talk about with other people. So it was really cool to be able to have this conversation with Claude. Again, very grateful for it. And I hope that you all get to learn or, you know, get some insight into some of the things that we believe in and hope for other brothers like ourselves. So, this was a real one that I hope you all enjoy as much as I did. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Claude King. Enjoy. What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of My Black is Transnational. And here I have my special guest for today's show. A good brother of mine going way back, all the way to undergrad. This is my fraternal brother, so we'll put that first and foremost. But before that, you know, professionally, a licensed clinical professional counselor, You know, psychotherapist extraordinaire. My good brother, Claude King, is in the building, and we're here to talk about some real, real stuff. So, man, Claude, bro, thank you so much. I know you got the baby sleep. We both got the baby sleep, and but thank you for making time to talk with me today.
Of course, man. Thank you for inviting me. We've been talking about doing this for a while, so yeah. I appreciate you for extending the invite, and I'm excited to see where this conversation goes today.
Likewise, bro. Likewise, because I didn't got no script for this one, dog. So we gonna do what to do. But yeah, so before I get into it, I usually allow my guests to just provide a little bit more because I always try to introduce, but I also want to make sure that you share with the audience just who you are, anything interesting about yourself, and then we'll get into the question and answer the conversation.
Yeah, so whenever people ask me this question, I have a hard time with it because I don't know how far back to go. So I'll give like a brief overview. So I am a psychotherapist. I've been in the field since 2013. So got my bachelor's in psychology from U of I in 2010. Mm-hmm. I took a year off of school because I really didn't know how I wanted to use that degree. I started working as a dormitory counselor for a residential facility in 2010, really loved the job. And then I ended up going back to school and getting my master's in marriage and family counseling. Okay. I finished that program in 2013. And since then, I've been working in a variety of different settings in the mental health field. Did a lot of work in residential facilities, working with kids with social and emotional behavior disorders. Mm-hmm. These were kids that were in the foster care system that had kind of been going from placement to placement, and the placements really didn't work out. So they sent them to a higher level of care. So I worked there as a counselor for them. And I did a lot of work in high schools, elementary schools across Chicago as an outside provider. We'll pull kids out of class, do individual counseling sessions with them, run stress management groups, and then also do professional development trainings for staff on like mental health, wellness topics, how to, you know, implement trauma-informed interventions with children. Mm. And then around 2018, I got my clinical license. And then I had been working in not-for-profits that whole time. So I was really excited about starting my own practice. Yeah. So I started my practice, CK Psych, in 2018. Yeah. And it's located in the Beverly neighborhood of Chicago. So I've been doing that part-time since then. And then most recently, as of 2021, I got an amazing opportunity to be an employee assistant consultant for Discover Financial. They have a call center that opened up in the Chatham neighborhood about 3 years ago. And that's my full-time gig. Mm-hmm. So I'm there 30 hours a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And essentially what I do is on-site counseling for the employees there, which is really great because it really helps to reduce the or increase the access to mental health care. So for a lot of the employees that work there, I'm their first interaction with a therapist. Mm. And I get an opportunity to meet with them on site. I do trainings on different mental health wellness topics once or twice a month. I do crisis intervention work and also do consultations with management. So if there's any type of broad organizational transition or change, whether it's like a reduction in workforce, people getting laid off, a new administration that's coming in, or any changes in like the policies or procedures that are happening on site, mm-hmm. they might consult with me just to get an idea of how it's impacting the employees and how they can better support them. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially what I'm doing. As of like September, I decided to go back to school. It's something that I said I was never going to do. and here I am. Yeah. I'm in a program for sport and performance psych. It's a certificate program, and I'll be done in a year and a half. And my whole goal with that is just to be able to kind of transition or parlay some of the counseling skills I already have, but gear them towards working with athletes to help them perform better on the field.
Right.
So that's in a nutshell what I'm doing right now.
Nah, bro, you gave me the CV, bro. And that's, you know, I appreciate it. but I want to know about you. Like, I mean, we want to know about, you know, where you from? How do you culturally identify yourself, right? Like, what are the things that are important to your values, right? And of course, you know, I mean, in terms of just keeping things personal, personal, you don't have to get into the family stuff if you don't want to, but I really want to know about, like, cultural background. How do you identify where you from, or what do you, you know, how do you tie your roots?
Okay, yeah. So I'm originally from Chicago, Southsider, lived in a lot of different areas around Chicago. My dad is a United Methodist pastor. My mom is a retired CPS school teacher. She taught in Englewood for 35 years. In the United Methodist denomination, pastors get appointed to different churches, and we like move to where the need is at. So because of that, I moved around a lot. So my early part of my childhood started off in Chicago. We lived in the Morgan Park, Roseland area. Went to school out there. And then when I was like five, we moved to Chicago Heights in the South Burbs, lived there for like 2 or 3 years. Then we moved back to Chicago when my grandfather died unexpectedly from a heart attack, to move in with my grandma to support her. And that was like a difficult transition for me because the Chicago high school I was going to was predominantly white at the time. So I was used to just being the only Black kid in the class, even though the community was diverse, the school was predominantly white. So then we moved to Morgan Park area. The school I was going to was in Roseland. And
culture
like
shock.
That was complete culture
shock
for me.
Yeah.
So like I had to get readjusted to being in like the all Black, you know, community, all Black school again. But, you know, after like a year, I kind of hit my stride. I was like, you know, just really thriving, flourishing. Then my dad got appointed to a new church in Glen Ellen when I was in eighth grade. And then we moved back out there. And for those who don't know where Glen Ellen is, it's a very small, tight-knit suburban community, about 40 minutes west of Chicago, conservative, another culture shock for me. So, you know, I had to get used to that. Didn't really like the high school that I went to in particular. Especially because there wasn't a lot of diversity. I was usually like the only Black kid in my class, especially because I was taking like honors and AP courses. And it was just challenging time for our whole family. My dad was battling a lot of racism at his job. I was dealing with a lot of microaggressions from my classmates. For a lot of them, they hadn't had too many interactions with Black kids before, especially Black kids from Chicago. So they had all of these, you know, stereotypes and ideas of like how I was gonna act. You know, I came from a two-parent household, you know, family was middle class. Both my parents got master's degrees. So like to them, I'm like, you're not like the type of Black kid or Black family that I see on TV or like the Black people that I listen, you know, when I, you know, listen to hip hop and rap, you know, and watching music videos and stuff like that. So I had to battle a lot of stereotypes, and it was challenging for me. That was kind of like my first experience dealing with mental health. I didn't really realize it at that time, but I was I got really depressed. I started to struggle with my confidence. I became very kind of insular and recluse. I wasn't really good about talking about how I felt because our family wasn't like that. You know, my mom was battling depression on her own and I didn't want to burden her with my issues. So I just kind of dealt with everything myself. My dad was very emotionally available, but he wasn't always at home because he was dealing with stuff with the church. So I just dealt with a lot internally, and I wish I would have had somebody like myself to talk to at that time, because they could have helped me navigate through a lot of the issues that I was dealing with at that time. So that's, I think it was at that time I kind of decided I wanted to work with people. I wanted to help people. I didn't really know in what capacity I wanted to do it with. But once I went to college and I majored in psychology, I was like, okay, I can see myself doing this. So, yeah, that's pretty much Kind of like my early childhood, up until like I went to college.
Yeah. So, like, I'm curious based off what you're saying. Like, I want to know, how did you, or did, were you even at that point in life to work? Because being, you know, what people, you know, affectionately call a PK, but like, and also dealing with issues related to mental health. And now that you've evolved to a professional, but when you were going through it and, you know, just being a, you know, young teenager, young man growing, how were you able to leverage faith and that, right? Like, was that something that you had to negotiate, or was that something that you just was like, yo, we going one or the other, I ain't even relying on that. Like, I want to know how you, how did you respond to try to utilize that, being in a home that is, you know, guided by a pastor.
That's a really great question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. Well, I guess the short answer to that is mental health was not really talked about in my family like that. I think a lot of Black people in general, we can relate to that. It wasn't something that was outwardly discussed, even though you knew people were kind of going through things. So it was never something I had to really like negotiate or make room for. My Christian faith was definitely kind of the guiding force in my life. Went to church every Sunday, was in youth group, Bible study, vacation Bible school, like community service. Like my dad had us doing daily devotionals every night before we went to sleep, praying. Like that was the guiding force, and that's a lot of my values are grounded in my faith. It wasn't until I think I got to college where I started to have to really think more intentionally about how this fits in with my faith. A lot of the narratives around Christianity are around cast all your anxieties onto God and He'll take care of it, pray it away, give it to God. A lot of those narratives, and like a lot of that doesn't really fit in with mental health. And I remember having conversations with my dad about some of this stuff, and he's like a huge advocate of mental health. And I think he helped put some things into context for me. And I think it was a conversation we had one time, and he said that something to the effect that there's some things that do not fall within the scope of the church that you have to refer out for mental health professionals. He does premarital counseling before he marries couples, and if he sees that there's any issues that are surfacing that are beyond his scope, then he refers to a therapist. So I think kind of indirectly, I realized that there's definitely places, there's a place for both mental health in the church, and just through conversations with other people, kind of like coming up with this idea that, the church, or not church, God puts mental health professionals on earth for a
Right,
reason. We're
exactly.
healers, just like pastors and other people that are faith-driven are too. And there are some issues like, abuse that happen, or psychosis, that it's okay to have faith in God and pray to Him and receive support from a church community, but also there's other people too that can give you a little bit more practical help on how to navigate through these issues and teach you how to cope with them effectively. So that's kind of how I've been able to piece together those two, mental health in the church.
You know, like, just an interesting observation for me in retrospect about you in terms of how these things evolved. And it wasn't even something that dawned on me until, like, I was like, man. And I'm not even trying to be funny, but you might chuckle about it. But I'm thinking about after we brought you in, you know, once we went through the process of joining our fraternity, like, we ain't see you for a week. Once we crossed, man, like, and I mean, I did something similar, but not to the effect of you. And now I think of, I mean, initially I was joking. I remember joking. I was like, bro, just need a mental break from all of us,
That's
right?
exactly what it
And
was too.
I know, I mean, I remember you told me later on, like, you came in, he was, and I thought about it and I was like, man, like, this is something, you know, that, like, I wish more people really did, because you were ahead of yourself, you know. Now in college atmospheres and college environments, this is something a lot of students are starting to now take advantage of in terms of not in a negative way, but they're more conscious about it and are really taking ownership of their mental health and protecting it, right? And trying to make sure that, because college in itself is a very crazy environment. You're asked to do a lot. In addition to what else we, the extracurricular that we went through, you know, in being in organizations and being part of other leadership programs, whatever the case may be, right? And so I was like, man, like this is how I know he ain't playing about this mental health stuff, because he was practicing it way before, right? Like taking that time off, whether people was looking for him or not. And so that was something that always stood out to me, that I was just like, man, like, yeah, that is a real thing. And I'm glad that, you know, you did that, because I encourage anybody to do that if necessary. But going back to your upbringing, absolutely. Going back to your upbringing, bro, like, you know, because what I really want to capture in our conversations is, of course, we're going to talk about, like, you know, being Black men and masculinity and fatherhood and everything that comes in between it. But you kind of touched on it already in terms of, okay, that idea of the microaggressions, being in these spaces. So was Glenn Ellen the first time, like, you really, like, started to acknowledge your Blackness? Like, was it really, or were you always known and told, like, you're a Black man, you're coming up as a young Black man, we are a Black family, or was it just like outside and everything that you kind of described as far as being in high school? So when did you really start getting an essence of who you are and the impact of being Black and a man?
Yeah, I think it was definitely fortified. There was a school I went to called, it was St. John de La Salle Catholic school. It was in Roseland.
Yeah.
And that school was very big on Black pride. And every day before we would go into class, we would say the national anthem, and then we would say the Black national anthem. Mm-hmm. And we would celebrate Kwanzaa. And a big part of the curriculum was teaching us Black history and being proud of being Black. So I think I had a strong Black identity, you know, from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And my parents always made sure to let me know that I'm a Black man, a young Black boy in America, and I have to navigate through society a little bit differently. I have to be conscious of certain things. You know, I might have to work twice as hard as my white counterparts to get to where I'm trying to go. And just my dad's side of the family in general has a really rich history with this, I would just say, like racism and like other things too. Like my great grandfather, John Lucas King, was an activist in Starkville, Mississippi. He did like a lot of things for that community. Oh, wow. And he actually has like this huge like memorial down there with like his face. He has a park named after him. So then like I've like heard those stories. And then my grandfather, he was like interviewed by like a lot of like newspapers and magazines like back in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. After the war, my grandfather, and he moved, you know, my aunts and uncles and my dad to the Trumbull Park projects. And at that time, it was majority white. It's on the southeast side of Chicago, and it was majority white. There was maybe like 3 Black families and like some Hispanic families. And he would literally get like chased, just like going to work every day, like by like angry white mobs. They were trying to kick him out of, you know, out of the housing projects. There's like this story that's, you can like Google it, where he was like running, he got on a bus, they like shattered all the windows on the bus, told him to get off. So like that happened. My dad would tell me stories about playing with some of the white kids when he was like 5-6 years old, and then, you know, them getting chased out of parks, you know, kids throwing rocks at them and stuff like that. And then they were like the first first Black family to move into the Washington Heights neighborhood in the early 60s too. So like, I've like heard these stories growing up. So I'm like well aware of like, you know, that I'm Black, and then like the history of racism and how it's impacted my family.
Yeah.
So that was something I just knew from a very young age.
Yeah. See, I always am not fascinated, but it hits me because for me, being an immigrant, coming in at a young age, around, you know, 7, 8, like, these were things that I had to, like, actually go out and get, right? Because in my house, that wasn't what I was told. Like, I was told that I was an immigrant, and if I fuck up, I can get my ass sent back, right? Like, it was basically that, right? And so, you know, the idea of, you know, being out there, I didn't understand the risk of being a young Black boy. Like, I didn't understand the risk of just, you know, the innate, like, risk, the inherent risk of being young Black and in America. I didn't get it. I was just happy to be in America. I was happy, you know, and fortunate that I had all these luxuries that I, you know, didn't necessarily, I had in Nigeria, but not on a consistent basis. And so these were things like what you described, the history, and all these things were, these are things that I had to go out and actually, like, learn, right? Like, I had to go to the library and, like, sit down and read books about what happened, because it wasn't something that was discussed. And I mean, no, it's not any fault of my parents, but it was just something that even in schools, like, it was the fundamentals, the basic stuff, not the in-depth, didn't learn about separate but not equal, like, just the basics. Slavery happened, civil rights happened, Bill Clinton's president. Like, what? And he cares about Black people. That was it, right? Like, that was it for me. And so for me, I didn't know until, like, 7th, 8th grade that this thing was a real thing, right? And I just remember being in a Catholic school, but I was in the North Side, and doing, in 8th grade, I did, like, a history project, and I didn't even understand what I was doing. I just did it because I felt it was interesting. I did a project on, you know, the Brown versus Board of Education, and I did it because, you know, I just thought it stood out. Like, I didn't know the magnitude of what that case was. I just was like, yo, this is interesting. This is what started everything in terms of desegregation, and Black people and white people, you know, are together now, and it's cool. And I didn't, you know, so when, and so the more you talk about these things, the more I hear others who are African Americans and have that direct connection. We're not even talking about one or two generations. We're just like, we're immediate. The person might even still be alive. You know what I mean? Like, they know what it is. And to still think about that being their realities, is, it just, it gives me chills, man. Like, because it's amazing. Have y'all ever gotten a chance to go back to Mississippi and see those memorials with your great grandpa and everything?
I've been back twice. The first time we went for a family reunion, I think I was maybe like 11 or 12, and then my dad's father died when I was 19, and we went back to Starkville for the funeral, and then they took us to the Memorial Park, the old church, because he was a reverend too, that he used to, not my grandfather, my great-grandfather preached at. Then it's like a group picture of all of us standing in front of the memorial, and there's like not a museum, but some type of like thing that you can like visit that has like all these different historical facts and artifacts and stuff like that, talking about like the work that he's done in the community. So that like instilled like a huge sense of pride in like my king name. And I think kind of unconsciously, I really internalized that. And I'm like, I don't want to fuck up. You know, it's like my family has done so much to get us to this point and they have a rich history. So I've always kind of carried that, with a badge of pride and honor, and like I want to continue to like advance my family, you know, in my own way. But I want to create my own path. I don't want to go into ministry like my great grandfather, my grandfather, my dad, and my uncles. I wanted to do my own thing. So that's, hopefully I can get to that point.
Hey, you well on your way, man. So just to kind of shift gears just a little bit, and we'll bring it back. But when was the first time you met an African immigrant? Like, when was the first time you actually realized, like, oh, we all not the same type of Black?
Probably college.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I ain't mad at you. My wife ain't meet her first African until she, like, met me, which is crazy.
Really? Wow.
Like, for real. I mean, I think she interacted with... Go ahead.
I forgot. High school.
Okay.
So Dono, Dominic, all went to the same high school. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Dono was like 3 grades above me. So I remember seeing him and never met him, but his brother, Dom, was a year, we're the same age, but he was a year ahead of me. So like, I got cool with Dom like my junior year. He was a senior. He's actually the reason why I went to U of I, because he got accepted And I was like, damn, you got accepted to U of I. I was like, I didn't think we could go to U of I. I thought that was too prestigious of a school for us. So
Wow.
him going into U of I and telling me like how it was, that made me want to apply. And then so I got cool with him. He would take me over to, because he lived in like a neighborhood, a suburb, like maybe 5-10 minutes away. So he would take me over to his family's house, introduce me to his mom, his dad, his like cousins and stuff. So like I got cool with their whole family even before I went to college. And it's just like, you know, they just kind of just like accepted me right in. It was just like, it wasn't even like I was an outsider. They just treated me like I was part of the family almost. And then I got cool with his cousin Neil. Me and Neil were in the same grade. And like, I never really talked to him that much. But then after Dom graduated, me and Neil got real cool. And he's still like my best friend to this day. But that was like probably the only exposure that I had prior to going to U of I.
And they, you know, they're from Cameroon, right? Yeah,
right,
all of them, all
right.
of them Cameroonians. Yeah, yeah, man. Shout out to Dominic, man. I haven't talked to Big Bro in a minute, but I gotta holler at both of them. They it's been a minute, but I know Dominic. They moved back to Cameroon, so I think they're.
Yeah, they moved back. Dono was actually in town over Christmas break.
What?
I don't know if Don was, but Dominic was. I mean, Dono was in town.
You got and, to see. You got to see Dono.
I didn't get it. I didn't get a chance to see him.
I know you got a kid. I know you got a kid. Reggie told me you got a shorty, so I gotta.
Yeah.
I plan to reach out to him and catch up with him, man. But yeah, so speaking of, man. So I mean, with everything going on, one of the things that is interesting. Okay, being fraternity brothers and all that is cool, but I think it adds to the conversation because, you know, these weren't conversations, especially now that you do a lot of work talking about, you know, Black men's health, mental health, you know, creating spaces where Black men can feel vulnerable and open to be able to express themselves in a healthy way. You know, these weren't things we were able to do, you know, in undergrad. Like, we've never had these types of conversations coming up, right? And so, like,
right.
I'm thinking, you know, what kind of led you to feel like, okay, bro, this is something that we need to do more? Because I've never had this conversation. We never had this conversation before, but I'm like, what led you to feel like, okay, I got to start creating these spaces. I got to start, you know, speaking more at different, using different platforms to share this because this is important.
Yeah, I think one of the defining moments that I had was actually in grad school. And it was probably like the first time that I really felt like I had a significant deficit in like a part of my life. Like I felt like I was always a good student. Like even if I didn't know everything, I was a really hard worker, so I could kind of like catch up. But this was like the first time I really felt like I had a deficit, like something I just had no idea how to do. We were in my second year in my master's program, and we had a group psychotherapy course. And the group psychotherapy course was it was very experiential, so we were learning how to facilitate like a process group by actually being in a process group. So like all of our desks were like in a circle, and then each week a different student would take opportunity to facilitate like a discussion. And the challenge was for you to be like very vulnerable, you know, share some like really probably intimate details about your life that you probably haven't told too many people about. People, you know, was crying in the group psychotherapy course and like all types of stuff. And I would say like in my program, there was only two or three other guys. Everybody else were women and majority white. And I was like the only Black male in my whole cohort. So we were in the group psychotherapy course, and a lot of the women in a lot of my classmates, they would tell these like really vulnerable stories. And I was just like so amazed by their ability to like tell this narrative and like be really aware of like how they felt in like each moment, and be able to like identify their feelings and like tell this narrative very succinctly. And I remember sitting there and I'm like, I'm not able to do that. Like I would recall, you know, experiences that I had growing up, and I wasn't able to identify how I felt in this moment. Like when this person said this to me, like, what was my reaction? How did I feel? and being able to like connect that to why I responded the way that I did. People would ask me about how I would feel about things that happened yesterday, and I had such a hard time like identifying a feeling word. And I realized at that time that nobody really ever asked me about how I felt about things growing up. And that wasn't something that my parents did. You know, I would come home from school, they would just ask how school was, and that was it.
Right.
And that would be like real shit that I was dealing with. And I just thought that was normal. I didn't know that, you know. So like I just realized I had internalized and suppressed my feelings so much to the point where I became very disconnected from them. And they would take me really intentional effort to like access the feeling. And I was wondering if other men had experienced the same thing, but like going through college and post-college, that's not something that we even really talked about too much amongst ourselves. We would talk about pretty much everything else except for that.
Right.
And once I started working with Black men in my practice, I realized this is an issue that a lot of us have. At first, I thought it was just maybe like me and a couple other guys, but I'm like, a lot of Black men are struggling with identifying their feelings. They were just so disconnected from our feelings. We really lack self-awareness in a lot of areas of our life. And I think I saw that there's like a need there.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is something that I kind of want to help us with and want to specialize in, is making it okay, safe, comfortable for us to talk about these very vulnerable feelings that we have a tendency to suppress. Because a lot of times the anger, the irritability, the depression that we have is like a manifestation of these feelings that we've suppressed for so long, and they haven't, you know, a lot of Black men haven't got their needs met. And so then it like turns into this, you know, it turns into other things that are a lot more serious.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like where it started for me.
You know, for me, it's interesting because, you know, growing up, I've always been very emotionally intelligent and intuitive of how I felt, right? And I've always been able to articulate and express my feelings, even in undergrad, whatever. The issue was, in terms of me growing up with my cultural, you know, knowledge and my cultural learning of the Black American life, because I was learning as I was growing, what the expectation of what it was to be a man. And I realized that I had all these emotions and feelings, but it was perceived as being sensitive. It was perceived as being soft, right? So a lot of my friends who I could really be vulnerable with were women, right? I have a lot of women friends, right? You know, and so even in undergrad, right? And then with the guys, you know, we talk about the usual, right? We talking about, you know, girls, we talking about sports, we talking about everything, like you said, everything. But so for me, this era, this time period where there is this push and, you know, there's more advocacy for, there needs to be more, but there's still at least now significant headway that's being made for us to be able, it's felt like a little bit more like relieving, because it's like, man, like, okay, now like, I got a space where I can be able to do things that, and this is considered okay. Because for me, it wasn't like, I couldn't just, you know, back then I couldn't just be like, yo, unless it was like, it's only a couple brothers, you can be able to be like, okay, this is how I feel. But, but it took a lot of confidence to be able to find another Black man to be able to say, hey bro, this is how I'm feeling, man. Like, this is how I'm feeling, whether it's about me, whether it's about, you know, me and you relationship, whether it's about this relationship I just had with this girl, whatever it is, right? This is to be vulnerable in that regard and not feel like it's going to be used against you or whatever, or you're going to be thrown back at you. It felt freeing to be able to see that there are more brothers who are really making a step to continue to bring these things to light, because I felt like, man, you know, is this, I used to always question, is something wrong with me? Like, do I have feminine tendencies? Like, am I, you know, like, I used to start asking myself.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, bro, because I'm very similar too. I've always been very like empathetic, sensitive. I can't say that I've been in tune with my emotions, because I got so used to suppressing it. But now that I've realized that, and I'm acknowledging that a lot more, I was very similar too. I think I just, the shield on,
exactly,
in a lot of different ways, just to kind of safeguard and protect myself, because I didn't want to be perceived as that.
Exactly.
But then like I show it all the time in therapy.
Yeah.
Like I'm, and that's like Well, one of the few places I feel safe being able to be like my authentic self is in a therapy room. And I like try to encourage other men to do that. But very similar to you, I felt a lot of the same things, but I didn't feel like there was any spaces where I could express it and then to be accepted by other men.
Exactly. And so then it leads me to ask you then, like, so being a man in this field as a therapist, as a counselor, and as a black man that's encouraging other men to be emotional, how is that usually received?
Yeah. Ooh. It's a mixed bag, honestly. At the very at one end of the spectrum, there's a lot of men who have been doing some self-reflective work already that are more receptive to that. You know, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to talk about how you feel. And I see that a lot of them want to do that, but they're trying to find or identify the right people to do that with. Like you said, you don't want it to be thrown back in your face later. A lot of men, unfortunately, say that they're not even able to do that, like with their girlfriends or wives, because it's used against them, or they're seen as not being strong enough or not having enough of a backbone and stuff like that. So that's unfortunate when I hear that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, and it's most, I would say, mostly with younger guys, like teenagers, young adults, they're still trying to like put on that hard, like, nah, like I'm not gonna cry, like, you know, I ain't gonna be soft or whatever. And some of it is a protective factor, because if you think about some of the communities that I've worked with, some of these boys, they literally are in survival mode. And if they do show any like chink in the armor, any type of softness or weakness, they're gonna be a target. So I understand, you know, why they're not able to do it in the environments that they're growing up in. But I do encourage them to, like, you know, find somebody, you know, whether it's, you know, a girl you're talking to or another guy, you know, family member that you can be vulnerable with, you know, or if it's a therapist, if they're ready for that, because it's not healthy just to hold that shit in all of the time. It's like
It's
it's
not,
literally gonna
man.
eat you, you know, inside and out.
Yeah, man.
So
There's
it's a spectrum. Yeah, definitely a mixed bag.
for sure. I was, it is one of those things where that allostatic load, like we things is just holding on and it stresses and stress. And at some point you reach a breaking point and you don't want, because when that happens, who knows, right? And at that point you when you reach your breaking point, you don't know how that is going to be demonstrated. And so that always is always encouraged to try to prevent before try to cure, right? Like if you can prevent it before it happens, that's something that's recommended. I think when we think about just masculinity, right? And for you now, having different models from your the lineage of the King family to you being a father now, a husband, how do you balance your professional knowledge with your practice, right? In terms of how you apply it to your family, to your as a husband, as a father, do you try to negotiate that? Do you separate it? Like, how do you try to utilize your knowledge?
Yeah, I think it's I try to synthesize all that information into one. Like I think about my dad being somebody who outwardly showed emotion, very empathetic, compassionate guy, but he didn't always talk about what he was going through. He kind of would shield our family from that. I'm sure he talked to, you know, my mom about that stuff, but he never really talked to me about if he was like, you know, stressed out or he was angry or he was like, he never shared those with me. And I think that was like a model of masculinity for me. And I think that's why it was so hard for me to talk about my own stuff. So like knowing that I try to be more communicative and expressive about how I feel with my family. And then also like the stuff that I've learned just being a therapist, and you know, with my son, Sterling specifically, I'm really big on teaching him emotional intelligence. Like, I'm like really big on that with him. So, like, anytime he is experiencing any type of big emotion, I like help give him the language to be able to talk about how he's feeling. So, I'm like, Sterling, are you feeling angry? Are you feeling frustrated? Are you sad? Like, So like now he's at a point where he can tell us how he feels, which has been really helpful. And then also teaching him healthy outlets to release that emotion. So like, he's at a point now, like he gets upset, he'll start doing some deep breathing to try to calm his body down. Or he's like, "Daddy, I want to do yoga," or "Daddy, I want to do this." He's like starting to identify in ways that he wants to deal with his feelings. And I just love seeing that because I wasn't given those tools growing up. I didn't know what to do with my feelings. I just suppressed it. So
Separate.
like I'm really big on teaching my son emotional intelligence because I want him to be able to talk about how he feels.
So for me and Jadena, I'm blessed to know that I think my son inherent like naturally is emotionally intelligent. And I say that because these are things that like we didn't train or we didn't like force him to do. He has some natural tendency that kind of spoke to who he is. And so for me, it's kind of one of those like, well, if you see talent, then you want to mold it, right? We're not going to shut it down. We're not going to try and belittle him or whatever. Especially for him being in a family, especially in Wanda's side, where it's all girls and he's the only boy, right? And so Jadena just has some. I mean, since he was like 1 and a half, or even when he turned 2, where if he sensed like someone, me or Wanda, upset or something, he'll be like, "Hey, Dad, like, take a deep breath." Count of four, right? Like it just I promise you, I BS you not. I'm saying this on as this show is going live. Like he will just be like, "Hey, Dad, take a deep breath. Count to four." Whether you saw it on TV or whatever, but he would apply. Like I always talk about just this. He just knew when to say the right things to alleviate, like not just stress, but he knew how to diffuse. That's the word I'm using. He knew how to diffuse tension. Like he's very good at it. It's natural, bro. Like there's a time, bro. Like I joke about it. I think I posted it on Instagram one time, but like I was dead serious. Where he, two instances I'll talk about. But like the first instance was he had did a crazy poop in a diaper, bro. This was like a real, real one. I was like, this is an adult. This is an
Yeah, when them
adult. Yeah, bro.
blowout
He
joints.
gave me an adult one. The first thing in the morning, bro. Like I was like, oh my God, not ready for this. But like even in that, like he can set, like he saw it in my face. Like usually he doesn't say anything. He just be like, bro, change this diaper. This is your job. But like he saw the like the just the reluctance in me, right?
Frustration.
Like the frustration, and I'm changing him. And he was like, "Dad, I love you. Like, thank you. Like, I promise you, bro." Like, I was like, "What in the hell, bro?"
How old was he when he did this?
Two, two.
Wow.
He's like, "Dad, I love you, Dad." And I was like, "He's like, thanks, Dad." Like, he just do little things like that where he just, he's very affectionate. He's the sweet one. We call him sweet and sour because he do wild stuff, but like, he also is a very sweet, naturally sweet boy, right? And so for me, it scares the mess out of me because I take him to these other spaces. I take him to daycare, and that's one of the things I tell him is like, it's like, damn, like I have to, he's naturally sweet and affectionate and tender, but I also know that he's going out in that world, and we have to, kind of, we have to kind of chisel that into something a little bit more because he can't go out there as a young black boy like that. The world will eat him alive, right? And so it breaks my heart. Because I know what he wants to be naturally, but I know what he's going to end up having to be based off. If I don't protect him from that, if I don't re get him preparing for that, it just so it's a situation I'm thinking about, all the time. Even just similar to you as a father, you're always thinking about your boy. You're always thinking about ways to prepare him and ways to, but the outlets, right? So those things are like when we think about when I'm thinking about his outlets, it's not much because he's already in stages where he comes to me and be like, "Dad, I'm frustrated." So the difference though is that for me, I don't even when I'm mad at him or something like that, like again, he's very good at diffusing tension. Like it's very, very natural. Like a year ago, actually, it was like a year ago from today, we went to the Kalahari. He was 2, getting ready to turn 3. He was at the Kalahari, him and Kiki, we're getting ready to go down to the water park. He was acting a fool with Wanda or something. So, I'm upset. I'm trying to get him in order, give him a timeout or whatever. I'm upset. I'm like, bro, you don't be acting, with your mom. Like, don't, calm down. He trying to have a little meltdown, whatever. And I just remember, like, he just turned around and it's simple things, right? But he just turned around and he was like, "I'm sorry, Dad." And bro, when I tell you I broke, I cried, like, because you know, like, that's something that, again, it's like, wow, your kids know how to get to you. They just do. But mm-hmm. that ability, again, it's not something I've never told you done. I mean, maybe now, like, as he's three and he plays with other kids and, you know, learning social cues and stuff like that. But before that, it's never been a situation where I've had to be like, Jadena, say sorry to your mom or say sorry to your dad. Or like, no, mm-hmm. he just knew like, this is something that I think will help diffuse attention, and
that's where amazing, bro.
He has that gift. That is a natural. He's just, in that regard, very, very astute in that area. So,
but I would also give yourself some credit, man, because it's like, kids pick up on so many things, like you being an emotionally intelligent man. Like, he's observing you.
That is true.
You know, so
that
is, like, true. You're right. Even though you might not have verbally said this to him, he's watching how you navigate, how you interact with his mom, how you interact with other people. And I'm sure he's picked up on some of those things.
You're right, bro. You're right. Sometimes I don't think about that, but you're 100% right. And so he does see that. He does see that. And that's something, and it's not something that, you know, we're just thinking about him intentionally, but it's something that is with our oldest daughter, Alicia. We want her to see that, right? Because she's the oldest. We want her to be able to see that. She's starting to learn how to, you know, develop relationships with other people. We want her to be able to see and learn different things from others. But yes, he's catching on as well. But, like, in terms of the outlets and getting him to express himself, my tactic has always been, I just want to give him a space to talk, right? And so that's mm-hmm. the thing that, like, I didn't get. That's the thing that sometimes, even within his family, he doesn't get, right? I think sometimes, mm-hmm. especially being around, like, a lot of all women, and I think because none of them have ever raised a man, right? And so there's that challenge as well, right, where it's like, oh, they don't know how to respond when he acts certain ways, where I see it and I say, oh, no, I understand where this is coming from. So I do give, I am very protective of him, maybe compared to some of the other kids, because I think there's some things they don't understand. And I don't want labels or anything thrown at him at the young mm-hmm. age, because I think sometimes it's very easy for that to happen, especially when you're the only boy.
Absolutely.
And so for him, when he gets into those situations, like, you know, where he's frustrated or he's upset, and he'll say, Dad, I'm frustrated or I'm mad or whatever. And I'm like, okay, Jadena, like, tell me what, talk, like, as best as you can, what's going on? And he'll say, you know, he'll try to put the words together. He'll try to point mm-hmm. at something, you know, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. Like, just like yesterday, right? Like, I think we were cleaning up, getting ready to clean up and get ready for bed, cleaning up his toys in his playroom. And he's very particular in terms of, he just has one of those engineering minds where he likes to put things in his own. He has his Paw Patrol side where he want to put his Paw Patrol toys, all the trucks, and he got his other stuff for, like, his big wheels. So, like, Wanda's telling him, like, hey, you know, just put this big truck over here. And he's like, nah, Ma, like, I would like the Paw Patroller over here with the Paw Patrol. You know, I was like, so she's like, nah. So she put it over here and he gets upset. You know, Kiki's the loud one where if she mad, everybody knows she mad. They don't do that. You can hear him. He'll whimper. He'll get upset. He'll, you know, move his head to the side and he has body language to show that he's not feeling it. And so he's a little sad. And so, you know, I'm just like, listen, all right, like, go upstairs. And I'm like, okay, no, let me talk to him, right? And it's so, like, amazing how just a little bit of patience, it's not always the easiest thing as parents, but a little bit of patience, just that just holding for that one more second mm-hmm. before you snap, just waiting mm-hmm. that one more second before you snap and just waiting to just see what happens, the difference it can make, right, in the interaction. Because that moment, I could have been like, yo, boy, like, listen to your mom. Like, but I was like, no, Jadena, like, tell me, like, why are you so upset about this Paw Patroller? And in his mind, he had a reason. He was like, this car right here is a Paw Patroller and it belongs with the Paw Patrols. Not only that, like, these have small wheels. The small wheel trucks belong with the small wheel cars. The big wheel, like, he had his own, like, reason.
It makes sense. It's very logical.
Exactly. And so for me, it's kind of like, we can't underestimate, like, our children's ability, especially this newer generation. Like, we can't underestimate their capacity to be able to try. It may not be the best. It may not be the cleanest, but their ability to try to rationalize mm-hmm. their process, right? And of course, mm-hmm. again, we are the models, as you just mentioned, right? So for him, but for me to be able to give him that space to be able to say, hey, Dad, this is why I'm mad. This is frustrating. And I said, okay, so what do you want to do? Do we want to move this? Are you okay? Can we, if we do it today, can we move it back here tomorrow? He's like, sure, but I would like for this to be here today. All right, cool. We move it back there. All is well. He goes up, takes his bath. Everything is cool, right? And so those are the things that growing up for me, like, as a young African boy, what? Like, that's not even me asking, me even having the nerve to even show, for me to even have the nerve to show any type of emotion to my parents, be it good, bad, whatever, was mm-hmm. not even expected. Like, if my parents mm-hmm. told me to do something, whatever, it didn't matter what age I was, for me to even give any type of, didn't have that, right? And so
you couldn't even have your face look a certain way, man.
Bro, you had exactly. To fix your face. Fix your face. And that's, you know, that's something that, you know, that's something still, like, even, you know, admittedly so, sometimes I have to talk to my oldest, and Alicia, to be like, listen, girl, we gotta work on that from time to time. Body language matters, but it's still true, right? In that regard, where I'm trying to create an environment where it's challenging, because I'm trying to create an environment that is promoting expressing yourself, but I'm also trying to retain a cultural practice and value that I think is very important, and I think is that creates a certain level of resilience that allows us to be able to thrive and persevere. And sometimes those two things conflict, because I want you to be tough enough to handle the drama, right. the right. tension. I want you to be tough enough to deal with whatever the shenanigans come across. But I also want you to be soft and vulnerable enough to be able to express yourself and be able to process mm-hmm. it. And that's not easy, bro.
It's so about hard to do that. That's like a daily, like, back and forth. Yes. Like, I'm always trying to, like, navigate that space. Mm-hmm. Like, with Sterling, just like you said, it's like, I want him to, like, suffer a little bit mm-hmm. so he can build up the resilience, so he can learn how to manage things on his own. I don't want to, like, jump in and save him.
Right.
But then it's like that pulls on your heartstring. You see your son crying.
Oh, man.
And he's struggling. And he's saying he can't do something. Oh. And it's just like, and you want to just jump in and just do it for him or whatever. So, like, that's something, you know, I think we all struggle with, too. And, yeah, I think it's just a process of trial and error, just trying to figure it out. I think we just get better at it as our kids continue to age, of just finding, like, that right balance for our kid. But I definitely can relate to that story, man.
Yeah, bro. It's something that again, like you said, it's a daily practice that I don't know if we'll ever perfect it. But the best thing that I think is our kids at least understanding at some point when they get older what we're trying to do, and being able to at least show hints of both, and then just kind of giving them the tools, like you said, just giving them the tools to be able to deal with it. And when they get to that stage, they'll be able to, you know, use it correctly and at their it's at their disposal. But yeah, so I think for you as a husband, as, you know, a brother, how comfortable nowadays are you in being able to express yourself, articulate your feelings, and be able to, and still be able to feel confident in your masculinity?
Yeah, really, really great question. I've made a lot of progress. Mm. I've made a lot of progress over the last, I don't even say the last couple of years. I'm not where I want to be at yet. But I'm definitely better with communicating how I feel. Like, I've been, you know, in and out of therapy for, like, the last 5 or 6 years. So just the practice of, like, having a space to come to every week to talk about how I feel mm-hmm. has, like, been really great, just in my professional life, in my marriage, you know, with my son. So I'm definitely more outwardly communicative with my family. I'm more in tune with my emotions, too. Mm-hmm. So, like, I could probably remember, like, a handful of times growing up where I would just cry about something and I would just hold it in. Mm-hmm. So, like, now I'm, like, more comfortable with just crying and having, you know, releasing that way. Mm-hmm. I think the next step that I want to take is being able to have more of those conversations with, like, my friends.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have maybe, like, one, maybe two friends where I can, like, go there with,
yeah.
But majority And I think it's because I don't want to make them uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because if you're a person who's very emotionally intelligent and you're in tune with yourself, and you start talking about that with other people, and they get uncomfortable because they don't like, I don't even know what to do
they
with
ain't in the
this.
same wavelength,
Like, I don't
bro.
know. Yeah, they like they get it makes people very uncomfortable. And what I find is a lot of men, they'll try to like, oh, let's do talk about this, switch the subject, or crack a joke. Oh, hey, let's go out and get a drink. It's like all these things to like alleviate the discomfort instead of just sitting with it. And I want to challenge my friends to be able to sit with that more and tap into their own empathy instead of like reverting the conversation to something else they feel more comfortable with.
I'm gonna keep it a bean with you, bro. Like, I've been so like, I mean, I understand going out, hanging out with brothers, going out, just not even frat bros, just in general, right? Like, I hate the club scene. I feel like I don't like going out to the bar. Like, I remember, like, Wanda asked me before, we never had an actual, like, wedding, and that's something that I said we do in a vow renewal, but, like, she was like, oh, would you do, like, a bachelor party or something? And I was like, nah. Like, to me, that's not something I want to do, because I think the best space that I would rather be in those types of things, or any type of thing, celebratory spaces. And I want to sit with good brothers and have real conversations. Like, those are the things that I value. I've always kind of done that. In grad school too, I used to, you know, create spaces where it's just a small circle of us, but we could come to the house and we talk about real things, right? Whether it's what's happening on in as far as activist stuff, or what's happening to black men, or just emotional stuff in terms of how do we build as brothers for to be better men to our communities? To our, so from, and I know, and similar to you, where it's like niggas will look at it and be like, you know, either that shit corny, that shit sell a song, that shit emotional, whatever. But that was the stuff that I cared about. Like, I don't want to go to the club. I don't want to go to the bar. I'd rather be able to sit down and be like, yo, like how are you? Like, what can we, you know what I'm saying? What can we do? If there's something going on, like, how can we be better, right, and get to know each other better in that level where we can support one another? There's a time and space for everything, right? Granted, like, there's a time that we could just talk shit. We could talk football. We could talk all that. I can do that with the best of them. But I really value, in, like, the most sincerest form, to be able to, with my friends, my male friends, I would love to be able to do that more, like you said, where you sit down and just talk about it. Because those are the things to me now, bro, that matter. Especially where I'm at in my stage of life. I'm not chasing girls out in the club. I'm sitting here day to day. And all I think about is my family, right? I think about my family, myself, in terms of my moms and them. As they get older, how do I take care of them? How do I feel? Because that also scares me. I think about my mortality, right? Like, these are the things that I, you know, I'm thinking about on a day to day. How can I be better for my kids? How can I create a space where they could grow up to be contributing citizens to society? How can I be better to my wife, right? Like, how can I be a better husband to my wife at times? How do I deal with the things that I, you know, because again, marriage is, you know, it's a lifetime, right? Like, it's, you're gonna go through the waves, and so how do I deal with certain things that I may not, because you're learning your partner every day. I don't know everything that's gonna happen tomorrow, so how do I continue to best process things? What are the best practices, right? Like, so those are what I want to do. I'm not trying to go to no bar and see some girl shakes. I'm like, I want to sit down with brothers who are married or about to get married or who think, and I want to get advice. Like, let's talk about what's to come, right? Like, that's what I wanted. That's the bachelor party for me, is like, I want to be able to sit down and have conversations with brothers who are married, about to get married, in serious relationships, and be like, yo, this is what the life is. These are the and it may not be the same, but these are the endeavors, and these are some of the things that I did. This may be what worked for you, but these are the things that we need to do to continue. Like, that's what I value more, especially at my stage in life right now.
Absolutely. I relate to so much of that, man. And it's like, I never, you know, I went through a period of time where I was in the clubs a lot too, but I never, it's like I was doing it more so because that's everybody else was doing. But it was never something I wanted to do in particular. But just like you said, I've been finding myself attracted to black men who are fathers. And like, I'm trying to, how can I put it? I want to like renegotiate my like close friends, you know, and put more of those type of people in my life, because I feel more connected to that community, like black men who are married, who are fathers, that are trying to figure stuff out just like me. And 'cause like, think that's the piece that I think is missing, is like having that community.
Yeah.
And because we don't really talk about how we feel a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of Black men are just operating in silos by themselves, exactly. Going through real shit. And then they wait until things get really bad. They have a breakdown. They get really depressed. They start drinking a lot, smoking, you know, doing whatever to try to cope with it, because they don't have that community of support. They don't have a group of other Black men or just men in general that they can talk to and get some advice from.
Yeah.
Like, how did you deal with this? Oh, you're going through the same thing with your wife? Me too. Like, how did you? So it's just like, we need more spaces for us to come together just to share and just fellowship with each other. And it's like, I find that a lot of us don't have that. Yeah. And it's sad. It's sad because I can see where that train is going to.
Yeah. I with you 100%. And for me, it's even more sad because, you know, to even do that is like the most un-African thing ever. Right. Like, I think that's something that that persists, bro. Like, to even I can't even tell you. Right. Like, just when I have conversations with people, with, you know, women, anybody. And when they try to connect the fact that I'm like, you know, Nigerian, or I came up from that, you know, West African lifestyle, and they're like, yo, like, African men, like, this is, most African men aren't like this. They don't show. And it's true, because it's very, you know, the idea of how, you know, we're portrayed too, in terms of what sensitivity looks like, and what, how, you know, softness looks like, and how it's a double-edged sword. And to some extent a standard, but like those types of things, you don't get that often. I remember being, in Florida, and I got into an argument with my dad. This was like the biggest, this, you know, so when we talk about like suppressing shit, right? And then at some point you reach a breaking point, and it turns out, so at some point, like, my dad, we always had these conversations, and my dad, you know, I always respected him, and, you know, you have that certain fear of God, right? Like, you have that fear of you know, your dad, where you're just, and at some point though, it was like, you know, I'm like, yo, I'm 20, you know, at this point I'm 27, whatever, but like, I'm like, bro, I'm 27 years old, I'm still out here trying to, and I think my dad says something to me. I was getting ready to take a trip to Nigeria, but I wanted to see my grandma. And my dad said something, but for my mom's side, you know, my dad, you know, so, but my dad ended up saying something about my grandma that just didn't sit well with me, you know, because I wanted to go see her first. And then I took off, right? Like, I took off, and I'm kind of expressing all these things, these things that I've held off from him, in terms of, you know, me feeling like, oh, it was never enough, blah, 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 blah. I just felt like I was always this constant pressure, especially being the oldest son, being, this is not, at least back from my contemporaries, this is not normal. This is something that is like, ooh, boy, like, you really doing this? So but I was like, F it, I'm doing this, right? And I just remember my dad, like, of course, he had his emotional responses too, but I just remember, like, my dad saying something to the effect of, oh my God, my son is acting like a woman. And that pissed me off even more, right? Like, but at that point I was like, damn, I guess I am. Like, I was like, whatever, right? And so, but I was like, you're going to hear what I got to say. It doesn't matter, right? And, but that stood out. That resonated with me. Because again, it was like, I can't express myself, you know, and at this point, yeah, I get it. We're going back. We're there's tension there, and there's a lot of, you know, that coming out. But that statement of me coming to you as a son, letting you know all the things that I'm feeling, the first thing that naturally, right, the most impulsive response that comes to your mind is, oh my God, my son is acting like a woman now because he's so expressive. And that's to me where it's like, if I wasn't mentally in tune, or I didn't have that resilience to say, listen, I'm going to be me regardless. Most people are like, see, that's the reason why I don't say shit. Like, that right there, right? That's the reason why I don't say shit, because now you're trying to emasculate me for being someone that's capable of articulating their emotions, right?
Right, because so, that was his discomfort that he was projecting onto you. He didn't want to acknowledge, I don't even know how to deal with this.
Right.
So instead of just naming that, like, oh, this is overwhelming, this is a lot for me. Now he's trying to make you feel like you were wrong for expressing how you felt.
So that was one of those, like, conversations where, again, I thought about it and I said, man, I'm on a fork in the road of how I want to go about, continuing to comport myself when it comes to these type of situations. But, fortunately, it was one of those situations where I think I just continued to say, hey, I'll be consistent in how I do it. Of course, be more respectful than how I did it before. But I think I told him, like, I'm gonna always tell you how I feel. And I think as he's gotten older and I've gotten older, and he was here last year, and I think he's even himself become more affectionate in terms of just like expressing his thoughts, expressing his feelings about certain things as he's getting older in age. And again, those are the reasons why, like, I start to do these things, because young African men, young black men in general, let's not create that divide, but I think just taking my experience, taking your experiences, I see parallels, but I also see how sometimes, like in my group, I think there's more progress for young African American men to be able to do that, because I think there isn't, they don't talk enough about the African immigrant experience and how we as young African or children of immigrants creating a space for us to be able to not just talk about the normal things, but then also the immigrant experience, and then also being black men, those intersecting identities make it a lot more complicated, right? Because there's so many different things to unpack. So I think there's a lot more, in my opinion, there's a lot more advancement in the African American side, because I think there's just that piece where now we're, now as young African immigrant men, we're trying to deal with that in our masculine identities, being able to express them, but then also like our cultural responsibilities, being able to retain them, but then also like our identities in terms of, okay, where's the perfect space to be able to, where can I truly express these things? Because again, many of us, these, and this is why I created my Black is Transnational, because I realized that there were many, especially younger, like I said, my contemporaries, who felt like, I'm too African to be American. I'm too American to be African. So who am I really going to talk to about these experiences? I want to talk to my African friends, but they look at me more American, so they don't truly understand it. I want to talk to my American friends, right? But they don't see it as much because they don't understand the African experience. So it's you get what I'm saying? Like it's a torn world, man. You find yourself in this. I don't want to use it. I'm using the term lightly, but it's almost like a purgatory. It's like you're stuck in between, where an emotional purgatory, where it's like, wow, where do I go if I really want to get these things? So that's the dynamic, bro. And that's why I was like, bro, I have to, try to get you to kind of to talk about these things, because that's the experience, bro. That's my experience for sure.
I've had several West African clients too, and they've spoken on that piece too, talking about my father is very, not emotionally in tune with how he's feeling, and I have these, growing up, I feel like I couldn't talk to him about certain things, and and it's like I've heard this story play out over and over again, and I just. And it feels like it definitely is like on a different level than for African Americans. Like it's a different level of intensity in terms of not being able to like talk about, how you feel. 'Cause it's, I think at least for African Americans, this because there is a disconnection from our African heritage, the tradition is not as strong, So I think we have the privilege of being able to like, not having to worry too much about tradition too much and kind of create our own. But like, for you guys, it's like very strong. Like, it's just literally like you have a strong traditional presence in your family that's constantly here. You constantly have to navigate. It's like I'm growing up in American society, but then I got, tradition from my home country, and like, how can I make those two merge together
Yeah, bro.
without being disrespectful to my family? But like, it's like you also notice you see things where maybe your family could improve on,
But
and it's like,
that's
how do I challenge them in a respectful way? Like, these are some things that we're we can do a better job with
But that's now, see, now just I'm gonna pause you right there. Exactly what you're describing is perfect, because now what you just described, that area where we can advance, we can be better. You know what happens? You bring that up and it's like, oh no, that's you trying to be American. Right. And that's essentially what, like, my parents would say is, oh, you're now being an American. Right. And they use more derogatory terms sometimes. But like, it's like, oh, see, we're not that. That's not us. Right. Don't try to be like those Americans. Now, that's not what we brought you to this country for. Right. And so that's then it's like, God, you see, now we that's a block. Now we're going back to that blockage where we're trying to make progress. But then now you're bringing that idea, that notion of us versus them, right? And that now creates that inhibits the progress of being able to have those. I mean, I think now, in fairness, I think some parents, especially you know, the ones who've been here longer, for the most part, some of them are starting to say okay and be more accepting, but it's not as easy. But now, before I take too much more of your time, bro, I did want to ask you, I'd be remiss if I didn't. Have you ever noticed any, like, historical tension between, like, or anything that's kind of alludes to a tension between African Americans and African immigrants from your time, whether as a practitioner or personal experience?
I'll just say this. I don't think, I think growing up, and I think it just came from just lack of just exposure. There was this misconception that, like, everybody in Africa was not doing well financially. So I think that was the primary thing. Like, you know, every African resident was just struggling financially, you know, or was living in villages and stuff like that. And you see, like, the commercials and stuff, like, the kids starving. So it's like, that was our frame of reference as an African American. And then, like, you know, I meet Dono's family, and, like, they're doing well off. And that's, like, that helped to kind of change my perception. And, of course, like meeting you, you know, and all the other, you know, Nigerians, Ghanaians that went to U of I. And that's like, oh, this is just, you know, this is a very, like, limited scope or view of West Africans. So that was, I would just speak for myself, that's probably, like, the only I guess misconception that I had, you know, growing up, and it was just because of lack of exposure.
And I mean that's kind of what it was for me. Was there was always, I always consider it two groups being told rumors about each other and never get to talk about it, and it's from the same source. Just told the same, like, been told different lies of each other. We from the same place, just been told different lies, and you never get a chance to talk about it. So my goal has always been to, and continues to be, us really trying to make space to be able to have these real conversations about that, trying to bridge the gap in multiple levels, right? And so for me, in having you on, was really focused on really trying to capture what it means to be able to talk to Black men, to be able to construct your masculine identity, and what that looks like, how it was from a professional experience for you, for a personal experience. But I really do think that more of these types of conversation needs to happen from cross-culturally too. Like, I think there needs to be that understanding, because I think there needs to be reconciliation between both. But I also think there needs to be, like, reconciliation internally in terms of your own, like, taking ownership of your emotions and being able to say, yo, it's cool. Like, I don't know what type of man, you know what, I don't know, that idea of, like, alpha, beta, you know, it's exhausting. I understand the context and how people want to use it sometimes, but I always be like, man, like, don't y'all get tired? Like, I don't know. Like, I'm trying to
figure. I'm glad you feel that way too.
Like, don't y'all get tired of trying to figure out because to me, some days I'm an alpha, some days I'm not. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I guess I'm hella fluid, but whatever. But I've never tripped on that, but I found that those are new concepts that I start to hear about, and I'm just like, wow, this is interesting. But again, I want to wrap up by just giving you an opportunity. I always ask these questions to my guests to kind of wrap it up. But with everything that you're doing and all the great work, all the talks, the seminars, all the, you know, panels that you've been doing, and everything that you do personally and professionally, like, what do you want your legacy to be? And I know you come from like, you know, a long line of legacy to be proud of already, but what do you want yours to be, you know, taking everything into consideration?
Oh man. I just want to be somebody that gave back to my community. I think about like my mission statement all the time in my head, and it changes, you know, like pretty much every other month, but I really want to help people be able to reach their full potential in all areas of their life, really just like optimize their potential. And if there's any type of mental roadblocks that are getting in the way of that, I want to help remove those. I want to help people increase their self-awareness. I want to help people to learn how to navigate through complex emotions more seamlessly, and just be just really just good individuals, be better individuals, for themselves, for their families, for whomever. So just helping people reach their full potential, you know, whatever that looks like for them.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Well, bro, hey, I said I was trying not to get it to 10:30, man, but we almost made it there. Bro, I just want to say again, man, for short notice, thank you so much, bro, for taking the time to come chop it up with me on this podcast. I think this is one of the more different episodes that we've had on this podcast, and I appreciate it because I think a lot of the listeners will get to kind of hear, you know, this side of me, of you, but I think it allows for us to be able to really be real and authentic. And so I thank you for being able to create that space naturally, for us to be able to have this real conversation. How can people reach you, follow you, learn more about your work, and be able to continue to get an appointment with you if they need your services?
Yeah, so my everything is CK Psych. So my website is ckpsych.com. Social media, IG, CK Psych. My email is clk.therapist@gmail.com. So if you want to contact me on any of those platforms, feel free to do so.
Yeah, man. Please be sure to follow Claude, bro. Thank you so much, Frat. This was a pleasure, and man, you know, whatever we can do to be able to continue to support you as you grow your business, you know, y'all part of the village, so it's without saying anyway, but whatever we can do to make this thing, you know, continue to grow, man, you're doing great work, and I'm proud of you, bro. Continue to support, and you know, whatever we can do, bro, we gotta continue to push this.
Yes, I appreciate you, bro. Thank you for having me, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to do it for this episode of My Black is Transnational. If you like what you heard, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review the podcast. You can learn more about this podcast by visiting our website at blacktransnational.com. You can follow me, the host, at blacktransnational_ on Instagram, or you can follow the podcast at Black Transnational Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. So until next time, my name is Dr. Kalechi Bay Lamberts. My Black is Transnational, and I hope by the end of this, yours will be too. Peace.